Case number 22-5751, Robert Reed versus Campbell County, Kentucky et al. Argument not to exceed 15 minutes per side. Mr. Mando, you may proceed for the appellants.
Thank you.
May it please the court, Mr. O'Hara, Jeff Mando on behalf of the appellants, Kyle Gray and Officer Curtis. Your Honor, I'd like to respectfully reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal, please.
Fine.
We are appealing the district court's denial of Officer Gray's and Curtis' right to qualified immunity on three separate claims asserted by Mr. Breed: his unlawful entry claim, his false arrest claim, and his excessive use of force claim. We believe that the district court erred on the unlawful entry claim in two respects. Number one, there were exigent circumstances that authorized Kyle Gray and Officer Curtis to enter Mr. Reed's home.
Didn't the district judge find that there were not?
The district court found that they were not. The district court found that there was an issue of fact based upon whether or not Officers Gray and Curtis reviewed the entries on the dispatch logs. We dispute that we did, but for purposes of arguing the summary judgment in this appeal, we will concede that point. We will concede the points in a light most favorable to Mr.
Okay.
Reed.
You concede the facts in the light most favorable to the plaintiffs as
correct.
Well. Okay, I mean, the facts are that, well, I think you know what the facts are, but I see you appealing factual determinations in this case, and we don't have jurisdiction over appeals of factual disputes on denial of qualified immunity.
Correct. What I'm trying to say, Your Honor, is the material facts in this case are undisputed. All of the activity was captured on the body-worn camera, which is in the record. The only disputed fact that the district court
found... Well, some of the treatment, I'd quibble with that a little bit. Some of the treatment of this plaintiff was not on the video.
Not
100%. They slammed him against the car and all of that?
Not 100%. But there were...
You couldn't see it.
But for purposes of what, if you look then at his testimony, and if you look at what the body-worn camera footage showed, we believe that the district court erred in not granting qualified immunity because the material facts were undisputed that would support a finding that the officers had exigent circumstances in this case.
Can you just list those real quickly? What is it that's the basis for the exigent? It's the fact that the door was shut in his face and he wasn't allowed to speak to the other people.
No, sir. That wasn't it. It was, we were out there on a call for a domestic. It was reported as being potentially verbal and physical. Officer Curtis, while Officer Gray was interacting with Mr. Reed, who was being hostile, Officer Curtis, through the window, saw a woman in the background who he perceived to be timid. And he was concerned because with victims of domestic violence, that is a common character trait. And
he perceived to be timid, but she was not injured, she was not hurt. There's no indication. I mean, timid, that's such a subjective perception to say that I can break into somebody's house because I thought somebody looked timid in the house. I mean, that's quite a stretch, I think.
This court in U.S. versus Goins dealt with a similar situation where officers were called on a 911 call to report to a domestic situation. An officer observed a couple separated on a couch through a window. The officer in that case said that the people looked uncomfortable and tense, and in that particular case, this court said that finding went towards exigent circumstances.
Well, there had to be some other exigent circumstances. Here, you really don't have much at all. The 911 call said, I hear a disturbance over there. It may involve dogs. It may involve people. I really don't know what the heck is going on, but I'm reporting this to you. The officers come to the house, they walk around the house, they look inside, and there's nothing unusual going on. They hear nothing, they see the woman, and she's fine, she's uninjured, and they knock on the door, and they demand to be entered in there. The plaintiff asserts his Fourth Amendment rights. Do you have a warrant? Do you have probable cause? The answer is no. Well, the officer said we have exigent circumstances, and then they break the door down. I mean, Exigent circumstances is an extraordinary exception to the Fourth Amendment's requirement of a warrant. And it's extraordinary to say that the warrant does not have to be taken here. And it's usually because there's an emergency. There's not time to go get a warrant because there's harm that's going to be going on in the interim, and you can't go to the courthouse and get a warrant. Here, there's no emergency at all ongoing. And to me, I think this is the harm that the Fourth Amendment is intended to prohibit.
I understand, Your Honor, that this exigent circumstances is a unique exception to the
Fourth Amendment. It's extraordinary. We should only invoke it in extraordinary circumstances, shouldn't we?
Correct. And there have been cases, though, that we've cited in our brief that we believe are analogous that support a finding that these circumstances were exigent. And perhaps more importantly, and that's a segue into, I want to make one other statement in response to what you just asked me, Judge Griffin, is Kyle Gray asked Mr. Reed to step outside to discuss it. He refused.
He doesn't have to step outside.
He doesn't. But
he can stay in his house. I mean, that Fourth Amendment is intended to protect the sanctity of the house against invasions by the government, by the British. And isn't this the type of invasion, the knocking down of the door? I mean,
The officers merely wanted to assure the safety and well-being of the other occupants in the house. And they are in a difficult
situation. There's no emergency to do so. Why couldn't they just go get a warrant? They could just stay there, look through the windows, go get a warrant, and then go into the house if a magistrate would issue a warrant, which I don't think they would.
Based on the totality of the circumstances, they made a judgment call that they felt was in the best interest of ensuring the safety of the people in that house. And they are in a difficult spot. If they leave, and if it by chance Mr. Reed was abusing someone in that house.
But he wasn't.
No, but hypothetically, if he did, they get sued on the back end because they didn't intervene and protect.
Could the officers have stayed in the vicinity and sought a warrant, and then if they heard a disturbance, then had exigent circumstances?
Hypothetically, yes, they could have done that. That was an option. But that's a segue into where we think the district court erred in a second respect, and that is whether the law was clearly established in this particular case such that every reasonable officer would know in a situation similar to this that they were violating Mr. Reed's rights by entering that house. The district court relied on the Williams case as the precedent for saying that the law was clearly established and therefore denying my client's qualified immunity on the second prong.
Why isn't the district court correct on that?
First of all, that case was decided in June of 2021, 15 months after this incident, and clearly established law has to be in a place at the time the incident occurred.
But that case said that there were not exigent circumstances in 2018. So although it was decided in 21, it was addressing the ability to have qualified immunity with regard to 2018 events.
Correct. It was based on a 2018 event, but as I understand the clearly established law, it's designed to say would every reasonable official in the position of the officers have known based on precedent that what they were doing was violating someone's constitutional rights. And all I'm saying is that decision was rendered 15 months later,
yeah,
so it couldn't have served as precedent notice to my client.
But what was Williams relying on? Williams decided that qualified immunity should be denied, correct?
Correct. And Williams was also relying on another case, Barton, but that was just a broad general proposition that was being cited for.
Qualified immunity to officers with respect to their 2018 activities.
Yes, ma'am.
Then they were saying that the law was clearly established as of the 2018 activities.
I cannot recall if Barton decided it on that basis or if they decided on the
Williams.
Basis that it was that there were no exigent circumstances at that time. I can't recall if Barton was decided on the first prong or the second prong of the QI analysis. But the other cases that we've cited, as this court knows, that the law has to be clearly established such that it's beyond debate. We have cited numerous cases in that are analogous to this one where this court has found exigent circumstances did exist. And so if you're looking at it from that perspective, you've got several courts saying that circumstances similar to this, they are exigent circumstances. Then certainly you've got the flip side, Judge Griffin, that you've talked about and the importance of the Fourth Amendment. So my police officers, unless the law is clearly established in the context of this case, are entitled to that deferential qualified immunity for making this judgment call on the entry.
That's your best argument, not that there's no Fourth Amendment violation and not that there's no exigent circumstances, but that it's not clearly established that they violated the Constitution. I mean, that's your best. I mean, you spend a lot of time on the other two.
We do, and I acknowledge my colleague's good arguments on the exigent circumstances, but that's why I wanted to emphasize both in briefing and today that if the law is not clearly established, if it's not beyond debate, then my officers are entitled to qualified immunity on that unlawful entry claim.
I agree with you there, that it has to be beyond debate, otherwise they are entitled to qualified immunity.
To what extent are you relying on the need to talk to the other people in the house?
We're relying on that. That's one of the factors that the officers were considering, is the fact that Mr. Reed denied them the access to be able to talk to those people to ensure that they were, in fact, safe. That was
and that makes more sense to me than the other arguments, actually, to be candid. Mm-hmm. If somebody was in there and had been abused and was just and the two of them were just waiting for the police to leave so that the abuse could continue. And the way you check for that is you ask, how are you? Are you feeling okay? Has somebody been hurting you? Which would go enormously towards whether any further steps should be taken. And this person was stopping that. That has some force. That has some force to me, but I want to, it seems like it doesn't justify the extent to which the officers took this. You know, they used a gun. They pointed a gun at him, and they
at his head.
They slammed.
His head. And a loaded gun at somebody's head.
At his head.
That's
troubling. If we grant to you that, you know, there was a basis for demanding that that the policeman be able to talk to the other people, and really wasn't trying to get into the house so much as to get. It was to be able to get to the potential victims. And there were other people in there. I don't see how you know. I mean, I think you could make arguments that it wasn't that hard to allow the police to talk to the other people in the house. But boy, they sure enforced that awful brutally, given that it was an investigation. I mean, if somebody is getting in your way when you're trying to interview somebody else, you don't pull out your gun and point it at his head.
He did it for a matter of 3 seconds. He did it after the door was shut.
It doesn't matter. The gun could have gone off.
It could have, but it didn't.
But more than that, it can scare the hell out of you.
He was going into an unknown situation with Mr. Reed behind the door. He did not know if Mr. Reed had weapons in there. He had experienced hostility from Mr. Reed. So he had it drawn for a period of 3 seconds in a domestic violence situation. It was a judgment call he made in order to protect himself and others. And it was never deployed. It was 3 seconds. I agree it's a show of force.
I never deployed. You mean he never shot it?
He never shot it.
Never killed him. Okay. We know he didn't shoot it.
Right.
Counsel, you say in your brief that the plaintiff prevented the other occupants in the house of coming to the door and talking to the officers. How did he prevent them from coming?
Because Officer Gray explained to Mr. Reed that he wanted to see the other people, asked them to come.
I know, but how did Reed prevent?
By slamming the door shut.
Oh, okay.
And saying, I don't care who called.
The other occupants could have come to the door if they wanted to. He didn't physically prevent them from coming, did he?
I don't know, but the fact that
you don't know?
The fact that they didn't come would lend itself to the suggestion that maybe there was something taking place in the house.
They didn't.
My time is up. I will refer to rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court, Mr. Mando. Let me jump into what seems to be the focus First of all, let me repeat Judge Griffin's concern that the Supreme Court announced decades ago that entry, warrantless entry into a home is the chief evil for which the Fourth Amendment was designed to protect against. Following up on that, this court and the Supreme Court has consistently held that it is the officer's responsibility to overcome a presumption that any warrantless entry into a home is constitutionally in error.
I didn't follow.
That's a presumption that the officer...
A lot of negatives in there. I'm afraid I didn't follow it.
The officers, once you show a warrantless entry, the case law is very clear. The officers have an... There's a presumptive unreasonableness to any entry without a warrant. That's a presumption that the officers in this case have to overcome. And the record in this case is about as thin as any record I've seen in a challenge like this. Now, Mr. Mando has cited to the Goins case as being the primary case, and this is one of the faults, I think, with literally every case they cite. There is a call of some kind of domestic, usually it's domestic violence. What the court will know about the dispatch log in this case and the transcript of the dispatch is the caller never identifies Mr. Reed, never identifies anything occurring within the residence. This is something occurring outside.
I thought it was unclear whether it was inside or outside.
No, it specifically says outside. The dispatch says this is happening outside. In fact, the caller uses the term, quote, I don't know if it's a domestic or whatever. So the call itself is very equivocal and gives the officers so little information that Mr. Curtis agreed that he didn't speak with the caller and that there was no way to assess the reliability of that call. That's at record 31, page ID 157. So there really is no information once they get the call that they can use to support this warrantless entry. But let's focus on the main thing that they're talking about, this alleged hostility. I think the court...
There is no hostility. I've seen the tapes.
Okay.
He was very respectful. He's just exercising his constitutional rights. He asked the officer, do you have a warrant? Or he says, no, I don't need one because I have exigent circumstances.
Yes, you're absolutely
basically
right.
He says, well, goodbye. Until you get a warrant, come on back with a warrant. And then they breaks the door down and puts the gun at his head.
Exactly.
I mean, it's outrageous to me what happened here. So I don't have any problem with saying there is a Fourth Amendment violation. There is no exigent circumstances. But this is a qualified immunity case. And once qualified immunity is asserted as a defense, it's your burden to show that all reasonable officers would know that what they did violated the Constitution. And to do that, we normally look at a case. The Supreme Court says that we shouldn't do it on a high level of generality, but cases are good. But often you can't find one with all exact cases, that maybe one case involves an apartment, the other one involves a home, one's at night, one's at the day, you've got three people rather than two people or whatever. But normally you have to cite some precedent so that would put the officers on notice that, okay, that this violates the Constitution. What's your best precedent on that?
Well, let me do that in going through each of the justifications that were offered by the officers in this case. And let's start with a dispatch call. This court in Williams versus Maurer the Supreme Court in Florida versus J.L. made it very clear that something more than an anonymous call has to lay the groundwork for a warrantless entry.
I just have trouble calling this an anonymous call. I mean, they were able to call her back. They knew her first name and where she lived, and they were able to call her back. So I guess technically it's anonymous because she didn't give her last name. But for all practical purposes, it was not anonymous at all.
Well, it was anonymous in the sense that even, as I said, Judge Rogers, Officer Curtis agreed that there was no way to assess the reliability of the call. And the call you're referring to...
Yeah, but you assess it by saying it's anonymous, and I just find that fanciful. I
mean, well, then don't go with.
Not entirely non-anonymous, but it's about as non-anonymous as you could get.
But they can't put the caller in any context. They don't know where the caller is calling from, for example.
Neighbor, and heard this sound.
But where?
And they gave the exact address.
But where? But ignore my concern.
No, anonymous doesn't mean that they didn't give details. Anonymous means we don't know who the heck it is.
Exactly, and I think Florida versus JL refers to that kind of thing. But don't go with my characterization or my concern. Curtis conceded that there was no basis to judge the reliability of that call. So that call cannot provide. But in terms of precedent, Judge Griffin, Florida versus JL, a 2000 case.
Okay, what's the site on?
The site on that is 529 U.S. 266 at 270. And then this court's decision in Williams versus Maurer, 9F4, 433, make it very clear that you have to have something more than this kind of call to corroborate some kind of concern that someone is in serious jeopardy.
Okay. Your opponent, your opponent argued that Williams v. Maurer, because it was decided in August of 2021, did not exist at the time of these officers' conduct. When did the officers' conduct occur?
April of 2020, Judge Moore.
April of 2020. So the Maurer case, Williams v. Maurer, was addressing conduct that occurred in 2018. And the Maurer case held that qualified immunity should not apply, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
So it was deciding that the law was clearly established as of 2018 because it would have had to have given qualified immunity
correct.
If the law had not been clearly established as of the actions in 2018, correct?
Right. That's correct, Judge. And the Barton case, which actually Williams versus Maurer actually cites and relies on, was decided in February of 2020. So it was, if we want to get technical, involving events that occurred, I think, the previous year or 2 years before that. So there's no question that there is definitive law on the issue of needing something more than a call like this, some cooperation. And this is interesting because the Goins case had that kind of cooperation. The officers responded to a call of potentially a woman being subject to domestic violence in the home. The residence was identified. The door was open. They looked in. They saw this man with his arms wrapped around the woman who's leaning away. And they also saw other cooperation, which included items, household items that seemed to be askew or strewn around, utensils on the floor. In fact, if you look at every case cited by the defendants in their brief, you will see some element of cooperation that doesn't exist in this case. As Judge Griffin, as you said, when Mr. Reed answers the door, he's very polite, he's insisting. He's a veteran, and he defended our rights.
He's slurring his speech or acting drunk?
I think everyone has conceded he wasn't intoxicated.
There was my question.
He was not drunk, Your Honor.
Was he
the
slurring?
Perception of the policeman, apparently there's the word, I heard one of them say he's drunk.
Well,
you know, you could quibble about whether that's actually what he said there. But then there's something else in the record about slurring of speech. Is that right?
That if you want to know the background on that, which I think was...
I don't want to know the background. I want to know what the officers knew or heard.
They heard what you saw on the tape. I'm not going to characterize that. He was not drunk at the time. The officers didn't charge him with public intoxication, didn't ask him for breathalyzer, didn't suggest on the tape that he was intoxicated. And by the way, that's not a crime.
You can be... evidence they have other than the 911 call is that the woman in the house is acting timid. Now, why doesn't that allow exigent circumstances that you have a 911 call and a timid woman?
Well, if it does, Your Honor, there is going to be no limit to responses.
I kind of agree with you. It's
not, and by the way,
is the argument would be that it's reasonable for the policeman in this situation to try to get some assurance that the woman was not being abused by talking to the woman. And when he asked or indicated that he wanted to talk to the woman, the door was slammed in his face. Now you could say that was perfectly polite and innocent, but you know, people are going to react and policemen should be able to control their reactions. But it also suggests, you know, that you're not going to get any cooperation from me in allowing these women to speak. And, you know, if we set a precedent which says, you know, if you're beating your wife and the police come, just slam the door in their face and don't worry about it because there's nothing they can do. And, I have a little problem with that kind of a precedent because they ought to be able, it seems reasonably, they ought to be able to insist that they at least talk to the person who's a potential victim. It's not hard. And the other side was asked, well, you know, what could your client have done? Why, what about your client? I mean, what's the harm in letting the police talk to the other people in the house?
Well, my response to that is, what is the harm in insisting on your constitutional rights? And that's
But that's the question: is it a constitutional right not to insist on being able to talk to someone in the house? And if the door hadn't been slammed in his face, he wouldn't have knocked in the door and could have talked to them the way it actually occurred. If you keep watching the tape, they came out and they said, "You're all right." They said, "Oh yes, of course we're all right," which was very kind, very nice. But go ahead.
So to respond, I respectfully refer the court to Florida versus Bostic, 501 U.S. 429 437. Holds that, quote, a refusal to cooperate without more does not furnish minimal level of objective justification.
This isn't without more. It's with a report that someone was getting beat up. So you got a report that a person was beat up. You want to check it out, at least by doing the minimum, which is talking face-to-face with a person who might have been the person getting beat up. And they're just denied that.
Yes.
And you're saying we just have to say, okay, that's your right. You can go ahead. Seems a little, seems problematic to me.
It would be problematic if the facts you're articulating were in this case, but they're not. There is no call and no suggestion by anyone, either observations at the scene or call to the dispatch, that anyone was being beaten up in that
home. Well, I don't know. All they have to have is a reasonable suspicion in order to inquire.
They need an objective.
And it's, if the call said, now maybe they didn't find this out, but the call said that there was extremely loud yelling or whatever by one person against either
a dog or another person outside.
Outside. And there was something about whimpering too, right?
I don't remember anything about whimpering, no. Everything occurred outside. Reed was never identified. Nothing inside, unlike every case that the defendants rely on in this case, none of the events that are alleged by the caller occurred in a residence.
Suppose hypothetically that when the police arrived and Mr. Reed opened the door initially, the police could see a female with a cut on her face or bruises on her face. Would this be a completely different case?
It would be completely different, and I think it would have justified, if at that point Mr. Reed had closed the door, it would have justified the warrantless entry.
So the key is that the observation of the one police officer was that the woman in the house that he saw looked timid.
Right, and in that regard, United States versus Lott, 954 F 3rd 919 at 923, quote, nervous behavior alone is legally insufficient to establish such reasonable suspicion. Again, United States versus Blair, 524 F 3rd 740 at 753, they again repeat that principle that nervousness is an unreliable indicator, especially in the context of a traffic stop. In this case, all we have is timidity. It doesn't even rise to the level of nervousness.
I think the bottom line is you have no emergency. Usually in an exigent circumstance, you allow the entry because you cannot get a warrant from a magistrate. There is insufficient time because of the ongoing emergency, and therefore it's an exception to the warrant requirement of the Fourth Amendment. Here there's no emergency at all. The officers could simply stay outside the home. One of them could go to the magistrate, request a warrant, come back with it, enter the house, and talk to the woman. Right now they could see her from the windows from the outside, and they could see that she's not being injured. They could stay there to make sure she's not being further injured. I think
They hit an unanswered.
I mean, I think it's very clear that there's not exigent circumstances that allow them not to get a warrant. I mean, the Fourth Amendment requires
yes.
a warrant. I mean, the language does.
Yes. And the woman that Judge Rogers is rightfully concerned about was in full view sure. of the officers.
There's no emergency.
Mr. Reed is not trying to hide her.
The question is, would all reasonable officers know that? Would they know that in this situation, you really, if you want to go, you want to enter their house, go get a warrant. And
well, in this case, question. And again, and I know my time is up, so I haven't had a chance to go through both officers' admission that there was no evidence of a crime, there was no evidence of physical threat to anyone.
There's really hardly anything here.
I agree, Your Honor. We ask the court then to affirm the decision of the lower court.
Thank you.
Thank you. First of all, with regard to the Florida versus JL case that they're relying upon to overcome a qualified immunity defense, that was merely a case that talked about a false arrest based on an anonymous tip, and that arrest was made in public. It spoke in very general terms. It would not put every reasonable officer on fair notice that conduct in this case was unconstitutional. Secondly, I want to follow up on a question that started about the use of force, because there was also a use of force claim that we appealed on. And in this particular case, the district court said, if the jury finds the defendants unlawfully entered Reed's home, any force used is excessive. I respectfully submit that that is not an accurate statement of Sixth Circuit law, because this court has said that you have to look at it in a segmented fashion. Specifically, a different Fourth Amendment violation cannot transform a later reasonable use of force into an unreasonable seizure. So we have to look at each thing in isolation. You can't use the alleged unlawful entry to automatically say that Kyle Gray's conduct of putting his hand on Mr. Reed's chest in the driveway or doing a pat down was per se excessive.
Okay, is all that on the video, Gray's actions of putting his hands on the plaintiff, or is yes. some of it not on the video?
The video is what the video is, and I know that the hand on the shoulder and the hand on the chest is on the video.
Okay, or is that all the actions that they allege? I mean, denial of qualified immunity, we assume the facts as alleged by the plaintiff, and you can't appeal the facts.
No.
So, and the exception is if it's blatantly contradicted by the video. Does the video blatantly contradict plaintiff's version of what happened for the excessive force?
Yes, one example of that would be that Mr. Reed specifically alleged and claimed he was placed in handcuffs, and the video flat out rejects that. Flat out shows that didn't.
You're not arguing that now.
I know. I understand that, but it was an example of what the video shows, and I believe it does.
Okay, what are they arguing for the excessive force?
The gun.
No,
deployment of the gun.
I'm talking about Gray.
It was the placing hands on, escorting him out of the house, placing hands on him in the driveway while they did a pat down, while Officer Curtis checked to make sure that the occupants were safe. So it was just a mere detention.
Okay, but not all that is on the video.
Officer Gray's the touching Mr. Reed is on the video. And I believe my time's up, and I wanted to just emphasize that there was some issues with the use of force finding that the district court made that we believe also warrants reversal on this particular case. We believe that we have established our burden of raising qualified immunity. The plaintiff has not met its burden to show that the case law is such that it was beyond debate that officers could not enter this house in this situation or act as they did. For those reasons, we ask that this court reverse the district court. Thank you.
Thank you both for your argument, and the case will be submitted.